Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
We are really cut to the bare bones right now, chipping at the bones, actually.
School district officials across the state are concerned about Governor Dunleavy's education funding veto. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 18th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a new book chronicles how the Fairbanks Four were wrongfully convicted and the unlikely path they took to get out of prison.
You know, what I hope the book does is leave people clear about what happened and who was responsible.
Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed an increase to school funding yesterday, saying the bill was too expensive and didn't include policies that he says would bolster school choice and improve student performance. Instead, he proposed a smaller funding package for schools. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone spent hours on the phone talking with the people who lead schools and school districts at the center of this debate, and here's what they had to say.
There were some themes.
My reaction was, once again, disappointment.
I think frustration is the word I'm going to choose here.
Frustrating and a little bit confusing.
It's our students that are going to lose out.
Those are voices from across the state. Superintendent Kim Hanisch in Unalaska, Ketchikan High School Principal Rick Dormer, Anchorage School Board President Andy Holloman, and the head of the Northwest Arctic Borough School District, Terry Walker. Walker leads a district based in Kotzebue with 12 schools spread out over a land area about the size of Virginia. She says each of those schools is the center of a community.
Everything happens in that building. Weddings and funerals and meetings, because it is the only largest place for gathering for the whole community. Oftentimes, many of the villages have catastrophes, floods, the electricity goes out, their housing freezes up, and the school is a safe place to go.
And she says her school's ability to keep that up is at risk. Schools have gotten infusions of one-time funding in recent years as lawmakers and the governor have failed to come to terms on a long-term funding boost. But she says costs keep going up, and she's looking at deep cuts to core programs, student activities, even second helpings at meals for hungry students.
We are really cut to the bare bones right now, chipping at the bones, actually.
So Walker is disappointed that the governor vetoed a bill that would boost basic per-student funding, the base student allocation, by $1,000. And she says the $560 increase Dunleavy is proposing instead won't stop the bleeding.
That does not cover half of the deficit that we are looking at.
In the state's largest school system, the Anchorage School District, School Board President Andy Holloman says leaders are in a similar position.
We're starving a little bit, and there's not much food on the table to begin with.
That's not to say the veto was unexpected. Lawmakers had been working with the governor on a compromise. Dunleavy has said again and again that any funding increases should be tied to policy measures that improve the state's school system. And senators stripped out those policy measures shortly before the House and Senate approved the bill. The governor called it a joke and said he would veto it before the final version even passed. Holloman's not expecting any surprises in an upcoming veto override vote either. The bill passed with a one-vote majority in each chamber. It takes two-thirds to override. He says he's just fed up with the politics of it all.
We don't actually understand what the strategy is.
I'm supposed to say here that Holloman is speaking for himself, not the board. They haven't had a chance to talk about it as a group yet. Now, the governor isn't just proposing $560 in basic funding. He's also proposing $35 million in what he calls targeted funding. That's an increase in formula funding for homeschool, plus an incentive program that would provide a boost for each young student who performs well on literacy assessments. Dunleavy is pitching the total package as equivalent to a $700 base student allocation increase. But school leaders like Deidre Jensen, the superintendent in Sitka, say that leaves them with a lot of questions.
Does that mean that we're going to get it beforehand because we've had good scores, because we've shown growth? Well, what does it mean for the ones that have been doing all these cuts and they're not making as good growth? Like, what does it mean?
Another question, where do we go from here? That's the mood. Uncertainty. Structural uncertainty because of the timeline on which the state funds education. Uncertainty because nobody's sure where the political football will land. Rick Dormer, the principal of Ketchikan High School, says he's worked in the private sector for Hewlett-Packard and Nike.
None of them run a business like this. So, and they make shoes. Those are dead, inanimate objects. We're working with people's children. I have children in Alaskan schools today. Like, I want them to explain why this is an okay business model and a funding model for people's children.
Dormer says he wants lawmakers and the governor to work together to figure out something. That was another theme I heard a lot in my conversations with school leaders from Ketchikan to Kotzebue. They want to see the state's elected leaders come up with a compromise that keeps schools functioning. Whether they will in the next 30 or so days before the legislative session ends, well, we'll have to see. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
The commercial fishing industry relies heavily on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for everything from marine weather forecasts to fisheries data. But NOAA is in the Trump administration's crosshairs again, according to a draft budget memo that's been making waves. The Alaska Desk's Theo Greenlee reports that many in the state's commercial fishing sector are worried the proposed cuts to the agency could upend the industry.
Unalaska can be an exciting place some days, but this early April morning near the end of the Bering Sea pollock season is not one of those days.
If they had a Discovery TV show about trawling, it would be called Laziest Catch. It would just be so boring.
Maverick Blake has been the skipper on the fishing vessel Progress since last year. It's a 130-foot trawler that catches pollock, although not every morning is as calm as this one.
In 2019, there was a pretty catastrophic wave that came over the bow and took out the windows and peeled the brow up and caused millions of dollars in damage.
Incidents like these are rare, thanks in part to improvements in safety and forecasting technologies, like a network of marine forecast buoys maintained by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Many of those buoys have been out of commission, though, prompting calls from Alaska lawmakers for more funding to maintain them. But the president wants to go in the other direction. A draft budget proposed by the Trump administration would slash NOAA's budget by more than 25%.
What are we going to do if we don't have weather information? People are going to go out and get sunk?
Frank Kelty has been working in Alaska's fisheries for decades. The former Unalaska mayor is now the fisheries advisor for the city, which is home to the nation's largest fishing port. He says safety's not the only concern. The proposed budget also calls for dismantling much of the agency's fisheries department, which does everything from rebuilding overfished stocks to enforcing maritime laws.
We're going to have a lack of information, and timely information is critical.
NOAA's Fisheries Division studies marine health, surveys fish stocks, and provides a myriad of fisheries data to policymakers.
But there's a lot more than just stock assessment work. They're doing scientific data, they're crunching the numbers.
Those numbers go to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. That's one of eight groups around the nation that manage federal fisheries and recommend catch limits, as outlined in the Magnuson-Stevens Act. That's the bedrock of federal fisheries policy. North Pacific Council Vice Chair Bill Twite says whittling down NOAA could make effective fishery management much more challenging.
The basic cause for concern is twofold. One is just loss of the science, loss of knowledge creates greater uncertainty.
His other concern is attracting top scientists who have already been under fire from the administration. Twite was speaking in a personal capacity, but he explains the council relies on knowing how fish are faring. Lots of fish means lots of fishing. Not so much fish, not so much fishing. But if they don't know how fish populations are doing, well,
if you're less certain of the biomass, if you're less certain of the status of the resource, you harvest more conservatively.
smaller quotas. That's where Twight says this could end up. Senator Lisa Murkowski is worried, too. She says the budget memo is just what the administration wants to do, though. It still needs to go through the budget process. Murkowski doesn't know where it'll land.
What we're seeing proposed, in my view, is more than concerning.
Murkowski spoke with Alaska Public Media ahead of Kodiak's commercial fishing trade show, Comfish, where she reiterated that uncertainty surrounding potential cuts to NOAA. And the Trump administration can still change the numbers in the coming weeks before sending the proposed budget to Congress. In the meantime, fishermen like Maverick Blake are wrapping up their season and heading home, waiting for news from Washington. With reporting help from Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, I'm Theo Greenlee.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a backcountry skiing and snowboarding competition returns to Haines after nearly a decade.
Alaska, and Haines in particular, is the ultimate freeride destination.
That's ahead. Stay with us. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, commonly known as ICE, arrested a Philippine national in Kodiak this week, according to a Wednesday post on X. Kodiak radio station KMXT could not confirm his immigration status or if this was the only arrest made during the agency's visit to the island. Both Alaska State Troopers and Kodiak police say ICE did not request any assistance for the arrest. The city's police chief, Tim Putney, says that's normal when federal agents plan arrests on the island.
There are times they might need a patrol car to transport somebody, but normally they take care of all their logistics, so to speak, the paperwork and conducting the arrest.
ICE presence is unusual for Kodiak, though, and comes as the Trump administration has ramped up deportation activities. The agency also arrested a Mexican citizen in Sitka last month. ICE posted on X that the Kodiak man was picked up over a previous conviction for sexual assault of a minor. According to court documents, he pleaded guilty after felony charges were filed in 2017. Margaret Stock, an Anchorage-based attorney and expert on immigration law, says it's hard to get exact information about his particular case, but she says individuals picked up in these circumstances still have a right to a hearing with a judge and to hire an attorney. A serious crime is still a deportable offense, even for legal immigrants.
So ordinarily, when somebody gets charged with a crime in Alaska, after they finish their criminal case and they get out of criminal custody, at that point, immigration steps in and tries to do the immigration court case, which is a civil matter.
The man is currently being detained at the Anchorage Correctional Complex, according to ICE's website. The story of the Fairbanks Four could fill a book, and now it does. It's called The Fairbanks Four, Murder, Injustice, and the Birth of a Movement, and chronicles how the men, three of whom are Alaska Native, were convicted with scant evidence in the beating death of a white teenager on a Fairbanks street in 1997. Marvin Roberts, Eugene Vent, Kevin Pease, and George Freeze spent two decades behind bars until another man came forward to say it was actually his group of friends that had killed John Hartman. The Fairbanks Four were released in 2015, and only recently did the last of them win a settlement after suing for wrongful conviction. The book's author, University of Alaska Fairbanks Professor Emeritus Brian O'Donohue, says the controversial case had a racial component from the beginning.
Shoddy police work caused them to sweep the four up, not pay much attention to Marvin Roberts' alibis. And he is the one that I've always referred to as the kid with the car. The car was essential to the scenario the police had for, you know, how they jumped out of a car, stomped this white kid to death, jumped in the car and got away. And as we looked into it, and I got students year after year in my investigative reporting classes picking apart this case, it just started adding up that Marvin Roberts had good alibis. And I think he's the only reason that this ever got a second glance. And how can you turn your back on that, as far as I was concerned?
And I guess, you know, full disclosure, I was in some of those classes, right? And we've known each other for a while. It just seemed like there were so many questions about that police work that in the very least, you know, we wanted to answer those, right?
It was not settled in any way that these four guys were all innocent, But what was pretty clear is that it couldn't have unfolded the way the police said. We did things like my students were interviewing jurors because we just couldn't figure out, why did you convict this guy? And one or two jurors said there was this one witness that was just so clear and so believable. But what he claimed to see at night after drinking for hours across a distance of, I don't know, it was 350 or 400 feet, we went out and stood there. And every single time, students who took part in that just were astonished because there's no way anyone could have seen what he claimed to see. And that resulted in jurors at the time, which we also learned, going outside to test it themselves during deliberations. And so that actually mattered more than the reality of what we discovered.
And like, just from a technical, like legal standpoint, they weren't allowed to have gone and done that without the judge's permission, right?
No, you know, it was lunchtime or something, and they wanted to get a little air, and they'd been in the, you know, jury box for a couple days, and a courthouse employee let them go outside. No one knew about it until we discovered it, I think, about 2 or 3 years later.
Was there a moment, though, where you realized, you know, all four of them should be found innocent?
Somebody confessed to a prison guard that, you know, they had killed the younger kid before the one that they were in jail for. And the state, I believe, sat on that information. They were notified by the prison guard. They sat on that information for about 2 years. But when that came to light, then, you know, it really became a huge necessity to free these guys.
And I mean, do you feel like now that Marvin Roberts has gotten a settlement and the other three had previously gotten settlements, is it over? I mean, what happens next?
That's not up to me to say. But, you know, what I hope the book does is leave people clear about what happened and who was responsible, and focus some attention on the state law department's absolute intransigent stance, refusing to recognize or act on the evidence that these guys were innocent. I mean, the book, I hope, will focus attention on that and lead to hopefully a different approach when these kind of things happen.
This is a big case. This has been going on, you know, since I was a teenager in Fairbanks, and I remember talking about it a lot. But are there bigger societal issues that you think are at play here that, you know, either came to light through this case that people have talked about changing in Alaska, or things that need to be changed still?
Okay, you tell me that if four white kids, including one that was a scholar student, were swept up in something like this, when it turned out that there was no evidence against any of them, no blood splatter, nothing that you'd expect to find at the scene of this kind of vicious murder, that those kids wouldn't have been kicked loose? I don't believe that. I think the fact that three out of four of them were Native, I think that was a big factor, and I think that kind of thing still may well occur around America. And we ought to recognize that.
That was Brian O'Donohue, a professor emeritus at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and author of a new book called The Fairbanks Four: Murder, Injustice, and the Birth of a Movement. The Anchorage Assembly threw out proposals for two firearm-related ordinances at a special meeting Wednesday and instead opted to promote gun safety. One ordinance would have made parents legally liable if their child brought a gun to school. The other would have mandated that people report missing or stolen firearms within 48 hours. East Anchorage Assembly member Karen Bronga, a former educator, introduced both proposed ordinances. Bronga says the goal was to help address a growing tension in schools related to gun violence.
I'm not an anti-gun, but I do know that when you look at the numbers of firearm tragedies in Alaska and Anchorage, something has to be done.
Branga says her proposals faced legal questions, though, particularly related to parental liability. And she says there doesn't seem to be interest from fellow assembly members to move forward on them. Branga instead drafted a resolution calling for greater partnerships on gun safety between city agencies. Ultimately, the resolution passed unanimously after a few amendments from other members. Branga's original ordinances were postponed indefinitely. In the same week, the Port of Nome took a potential $10 million hit in state funding. Leaders from across the country met to discuss the future of the Western Alaska hub. And as KNOM's Ben Townsend tells us, the future hinges on the $500 million project.
Residents and visitors take their seats in a packed Old St. Joe's Church. They're here for the city's first investment summit, a day-long event to drum up economic interest in Nome. Seated in the front row is Senator Lisa Murkowski. Nome's Mayor John Handlin welcomes her to the stage.
Senator, please come forward.
Murkowski begins her speech with some crowd work, noting that her mother was born in Nome.
You hear it all the time, but there really is no place like Nome. And it is special. It is special in many, many, many ways.
After a quick glance at her notes, she sharply pivots.
Enough about history. Let's talk about the future, because that's what really is bringing us all here together.
Nome's future is a bit uncertain. For over a decade, the city has sought to deepen and expand its port to allow for Coast Guard vessels and large cruise ships to dock. It has the potential to unlock a new wave of investment, but the $500 million project needs more money. Just days before the meeting, the Alaska State Senate stripped $10 million promised for the project, potentially leaving the city on the hook to make up the difference. Last fall, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers canceled contract solicitations for the project after fielding bids that were too expensive. The city isn't alone in waiting for the expanded port to open. Companies like Graphite One plan to ship millions of tons of graphite through the port. The critical mineral is used in electric car batteries and has, for now, avoided tariffs imposed by President Donald Trump. The Canadian company recently announced plans to triple its production targets. The city's port director, Joy Baker, feels confident the port will be ready.
We do have a flourishing relationship with Graphite One and intend to provide that export capacity for their increased volumes.
Nome's unique location just south of the Arctic Circle and near the Bering Strait is sparking interest from the military, too. As annual sea ice continues to retreat further north due to climate change, cargo shipping and military activity has grown.
And as you can see, these numbers, 242 in 2010 and 665 last summer. Anyone that is skeptical about whether the traffic is growing, the numbers don't lie.
After failing to receive bids under budget last fall, the city and Corps simplified their plans for the first phase of the project and sent it back out to bid. Baker says they hope to select a contractor and move forward with construction next summer. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
One of the biggest international competitions in backcountry skiing and snowboarding is returning to Alaska for the first time in nearly a decade. The Freeride World Tour is set to come to Haines next March, and as Avery Elfelt reports for the Alaska Desk, it's expected to deliver a boost to the local economy.
Haines has long been considered a dream stop for the tour, says Freeride World Tour CEO Nicholas Hailwoods.
It's basically coming back to Alaska after a 9-year pause, but Alaska and Haines in particular is the ultimate freeride destination, and we're very, very happy to put that stop on the calendar once again.
The event hasn't happened in the area since 2017. The tour announced the Haines stop earlier this week. It will be the fifth in a series of six competitions where skiers and snowboarders fly down ungroomed slopes, chasing a world champion title. The athletes have to start and end at a certain point on the mountain, but otherwise, they're free to choose their route, Hailwood says. Using binoculars, judges score and rank participants out of 100 points.
They're not allowed to ride and ski the mountain before their competition run, which makes it very difficult. And they have to basically memorize their line and show control, fluidity, and jumps.
Hailwood says after 3-year run in Haines, the event shifted to other locations because it cost too much money to get competitors and support crews to Southeast Alaska and into the mountains via helicopter. This year, the event has funding help from outside sponsors. But the borough also plans to kick in at least $75,000 to make it happen and is looking for ways to potentially contribute another $25,000, says Haines Tourism Director Rebecca Hilton. The funding was allocated during last year's budget cycle and then reapproved this year. She says the money will come from a funding bucket meant specifically for tourism and economic development. All told, Hilton says, the competition is expected to bring more than 100 people to town for about a week, depending on the weather.
And they'll be staying here in town, a few people up the highway as well, and there should be a really positive economic impact to our community, to different sectors of our community.
In a funding pitch to the borough, Hilton said the event could generate more than $400,000 in local spending, providing a boost to the town's economy in the off-season, when the area needs it most. In Haines, I'm Avery Elfeld.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Theo Greenlee in Unalaska, Brian Venois in Kodiak, Wesley Early in Anchorage, Ben Townsend in Nome, and Avery Elfelt in Haines. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.